I'm Brandon Hollingsworth, and from WUOT News, this is Dialogue. Tomorrow, Tennesseans will go to the polls to choose a slate of candidates for local, state, and federal offices. The primary is being closely watched both inside and outside the state because there are some high-profile races. Will Lamar Alexander successfully fend off a challenge from within his own party? Will Republicans be successful in removing three state Supreme Court justices from the bench? And who's paying for the avalanche of ads, signs, and brochures inundating the electorate in these days leading to the primary? Reporter Tom Humphrey and Laurie Kenny of the group Justice at Stake will both join me to talk about those and other questions today. Join us for Dialogue after the news. Minutes after 1 o'clock on a Wednesday afternoon. Today is the 6th of August. Thank you so much for joining us here on Dialogue from WUOT News. And today we're talking about something that's actually going to be happening not today, but tomorrow. The elections, primary elections taking place across all of Tennessee, in which we'll be selecting a slate of candidates for local, state, and federal races. And part of that is going to be very contentious for some of the candidates on both sides of the aisle. We'll be taking a look at that, plus judicial retention races. And joining us this hour, a little bit later this hour, we'll be hearing from Laurie Kenny. She is with a group called Justice at Stake. It's a nonpartisan watchdog group keeping an eye on campaign financing as it applies to judicial races. She'll be telling us what her group has been observing here in Tennessee with those contentious judicial retention races. But first, joining us on the line from Nashville, from the studios of Spotland Productions, is Tom Humphrey, the recently retired Nashville bureau chief for the Knoxville News Sentinel. Tom, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Brandon.
So good to have you with us. A voice probably familiar to many of you because he also does the weekly chats during the legislative session with Chrissy Kuiper. So, Tom, again, thank you for joining us today. And I want to get started by talking about what we observed the last time we had a primary. That was back in May, and I know that the voting, at least here in Knox County, was pretty anemic. Just about 10% of the county's registered voters even bothered to cast a ballot in both early voting and on Election Day. But this week, state election officials reported much higher turnout for the early voting stuff. Do you expect the numbers are going to be commensurately higher tomorrow? Is there more interest for this primary?
Yes, I think so. That was your problem back in May, is you just didn't have that many local interest races that were contested on the ballot. We do have several races coming up on tomorrow's ballot that should be fairly interesting. Mm-hmm. Knox does not have a well, Jimmy Duncan does have an opponent. So does Lamar Alexander. So does Bill Haslam. There are some interesting races. And we have a couple of really interesting we have a couple of legislative races that have attracted a lot of interest there in Knox County, and there are some in elsewhere in Tennessee as well.
Yeah. We'll talk about those legislative races a little later on in this hour, but I want to start on the federal side of things. You just alluded to this a moment ago. It's been a year of challenges to incumbent Republicans from within their own party. As early as last summer, we began hearing those noises about challengers to Senator Alexander. And those challengers have indeed emerged. State Senator Joe Carr, George Flynn, Brenda Lenard, others. He's still got good name recognition in Tennessee, but let's go back to just a few months ago. House Majority Leader Eric Cantor lost his seat to a primary challenger. Mississippi Senator Thad Cochran nearly suffered the same fate. Does Alexander have something to be worried about tomorrow?
I think Alexander has run a very smart campaign. I don't think Joe Carr has... Though he has a lot of Tea Party support, I believe the senator has very cleverly put some time in on the ground. He has spent a huge amount of money, about 5-1 to what Joe Carr has spent, and has been doing his bus tour. I think he's got his homework done. I believe the senator is in fairly good shape. Although he has a wide number of critics, and some of them are very enthusiastic in opposing Alexander and supporting Joe Carr. George Flynn has sort of came in a little late. He has spent $1.8 million of his own money into his campaign. You've probably seen his ads. But don't see him getting much traction with that at this point.
What are some of the other factors that we need to consider when we look at Lamar Alexander's re-election bid or chance to save his Republican nomination? What are, you mentioned being on the ground, being out in the community. What has Lamar Alexander been doing on that front?
Well, he's had a 35-stop bus tour here the last week or so, going around the state. At about 10 of those stops, incidentally, he was joined by Governor Haslam. So they are sort of campaigning as a team here in the waning days of the campaign. That has got him a lot of local media attention, I believe served him well. Joe Carr, on the other hand, has gotten some visibility with, you might call them celebrity conservatives, such as talk show host Laura Ingraham, coming to his support. He does have a very strong support among, it's like 30 Tea Party groups statewide. So he has a good core of support. We see that clash of the more established Republicans. Lamar Alexander is about as established as any politician in the state versus the upstart, more conservative Republicans represented by Joe Carr and George Flynn to a lesser extent.
I also want to spend some time here on the Democratic side as well. There are at least four candidates, Gordon Ball, Terry Adams, Larry Krim, and Gary Davis. Of course, they've been operating pretty much in the shadow of the media speculation around what's going to happen to Lamar Alexander. That's been getting most of the ink. Not so much with the Democratic side. Just give us a rundown on how that race is shaping up.
Well, the two candidates getting the most attention are the two Knoxville lawyers, Terry Adams and Gordon Ball. Larry Krim has been somewhat active, but he has had he's had very little money and very low name recognition, although he has run a couple of races in the past, ran against Corker last time, did not get the Democratic nomination. The Democrats are very intense on that race. There is a considerable rivalry between Gordon Ball and Terry Adams. Gordon Ball is a wealthy man. He has invested about $400,000 of his own money in this primary. That has enabled him to put up television ads and some radio and get his name out there, I suspect, somewhat more than Terry Adams. Terry has had a much more limited campaign, had about $80,000 collected last report. He has the rivalry, Gordon Ball will cause Terry Adams a progressive liberal. He says he is too far to the left, basically, to win in Tennessee in the general election, whereas Ball presents himself as more of a pragmatist who can win, have a shot at Alexander in the fall. Flip side, Terry Adams says that Gordon Ball is like a Republican. Why, he has voted for Alexander and endorsed Bill Haslam in the past, which Gordon Ball has repented of that, said he made a mistake.
Well, so
there's an intensity there amongst the Democrats, but the turnout in the Democratic primary has been fairly low compared to the Republican primary.
And that's understandable. Tennessee is a generally conservative state. I would expect that result. Does this tell us anything about sort of the disarray going on in the Tennessee Democratic Party in general? Because it was only 2 years ago that an unknown named Mark Clayton, who possessed some fairly extremist viewpoints, basically had to be disavowed by the Tennessee Democratic Party after winning the Senate nomination.
That is correct. And Mr. Clayton, by the way, tried to get on the ballot for this year's primary, and the Democratic Party, using the appropriate procedures provided in state law, blocked him from doing so. This year, they watched that sort of thing. I believe they are Mr. Clayton was the first name on the ballot in the Democratic primary 2 years ago.
Well,
this time, Terry Adams, A for Adams is first, and B for Ball is second. So,
actually, I'm just realizing here
one of those two will be the nominee, even about those who have not followed the race that closely.
I know this is purely coincidence, but I'm just noticing here from my notes that all four of the candidates, Adams, Ball, Krim, and Davis, are the first four letters in the alphabet. Maybe some scheme from the Democratic Party there, I'm sure. Late last year and early this year, the news was not so good for 4th District Congressman Scott Desjarlais. He was weathering at that time a litany of bad news, mainly from divorce filings. And it looked like his challenger, State Senator Jim Tracy, might gain some traction in that race. But he's kind of come through onto the other side of those turbulent waters. Give us an idea of how that race is shaping up right now.
Well, as you reference some of Scott Desjarlais' past history in divorce proceedings, and came out early. Actually, it came out, started out in 2012.
Right.
Involving abortions that he was involved in, and he was punished by the disciplined by the Board of Medical Examiners for having a relationship, an inappropriate relationship with a patient. Tracy is a state senator, fairly well-known fellow in the legislature, chairman of the Transportation Committee. They have really locked horns. Tracy has, at the outset, he was widely assumed to be leading that race. He had no problem raising money. Jim Tracy's raised more than $1 million. Scott Desjarlais has raised less than half that much. So there was trouble. There were some national people who said Scott Desjarlais was the most likely incumbent to lose in this state. But Desjarlais has a strong core of supporters. They say those mistakes he made in his personal life are in the past. They like the way he has voted. This is a Republican primary. And the sense is that Desjarlais has sort of gained some momentum in that race and now has a shot, a real shot, at remaining in office and beating back the challenge by Senator Tracy.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to quickly, before we go to break, look at two of the other races that we're talking about on the congressional level. As you said, Congressman Duncan, who represents the Tennessee 2nd, has a challenger. And there's also a fight going on in the Tennessee 3rd between the incumbent Chuck Fleischmann and challenger Weston Wapp. Let's talk a little bit about those two districts, those races, and your take on those.
Well, Jimmy Duncan is an institution. I don't believe he is threatened too much, although this gentleman running against him seems to have run a fairly credible campaign and has gotten some attention, raised a little money. The 3rd district, I think, has become an increasingly close race. Weston Wapp, son of former Congressman Zach Wapp, is making a run one-on-one against the incumbent Chuck Fleischmann in the 3rd district. That one is sort of the flip of the 4th district. The folks early thought Fleischmann would win that comfortably. Weston Wapp, however, has run a very smart campaign focused on his youth and attacking Washington and portraying Congressman Fleischmann as part of the problem in Washington, an angry congressman, he calls him. And Fleischmann has gotten concerned enough that he has done attack advertising back on Weston Wapp. They have got quite a melee going there. That could go either way.
Oh, interesting. So something to watch tomorrow night for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's not leave out our friends in the Tennessee 1st up in Northeast Tennessee. That's Phil Rowe's district. Does he have any challengers of note?
No, he does not. I think Phil Rowe is very safe and has no concerns about election night.
Well, maybe he'll get an early rest last night for sure. So, or tomorrow night, I should say. Maybe it'll be an easy night for him. All right, well, we're going to pause right now for a station break. Tom Humphrey will be back with us in the next portion of the show. We're also going to open up the phone lines when we come back. We'll also be joined by Laurie Kenny of the group Justice at Stake. We're going to get knee-deep into these Supreme Court retention races right here on Dialogue from WUOT News. Dialogue returns 20 minutes after 1 o'clock Eastern Time on a Wednesday afternoon. Hope you're having a good day out there. We are talking, if you're just joining us, with Tom Humphrey, the recently retired Nashville Bureau Chief for the Knoxville News Sentinel, And he is joining us on the line from Nashville right now. We're going to be talking about the judicial retention races that will be on the ballot tomorrow. And for this portion of the program, we're also joined by Lori Kenny. And Lori, we will come to you in just a second. But first, I want to set this up just a bit. One of the top races, of course, that we'll all be watching tomorrow night will be those retention elections that will essentially determine whether or not three Tennessee Supreme Court justices will keep their seats on the state's highest court. Cornelia Clark, Sharon Lee, and Chief Justice Gary Wade have been targeted by conservative groups for removal from the bench, and that battle between the judges' supporters and their opponents has gotten big and gotten costly. So first, let's talk about what sets this race a little bit apart from other states that have an entirely elected judiciary. In Tennessee, Supreme Court justices are appointed by the governor, then voters get to decide whether or not they can stay in office in 8-year increments. And to date, to my knowledge, Tom, only one justice has ever been voted out. That was back in 1996. You've been covering Capitol Hill for a long time. Is the current push to get these justices out of office a new phenomenon in Tennessee, or are we just talking about it because that's what's in the news cycle right now?
In Tennessee, it is a new phenomenon. It is completely different, well, not completely different, but strikingly different from the 1996 race that you mentioned, where Justice Penny White was defeated. She was on the ballot. That was not a regular. She was coming up for 2 years and was targeted for one case, a rather horrific murder case, where she wrote an opinion voiding the death penalty for the defendant. And that just sort of came up all of its own, bubbled up out of the woodwork. The Tennessee Conservative Union got involved. This one was an organized, orchestrated effort to unseat the three justices, primarily led by Lieutenant Governor Ron Ramsey, who first started lecturing on this earlier in the year and made a point of it, and who has put $425,000 of money from his own political action committee into the Tennessee Forum, one of the lead groups in opposing the Supremes.
Well, there you go. Now, that gets us into our next portion of the conversation as we talk about the money that's been spent on this race. By the way, I'd like to let our listeners know, if you have a question about the judicial retention races, you can give us a call at 974-5050. And you can ask a question of either Tom or Lori Kenny. And who joins our panel right now to talk about these races? Lori is with the nonpartisan watchdog group Justice at Stake, which monitors the money spent in judicial races around the nation. Lori, welcome to Dialogue.
Hi, Brandon. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for joining us. The money that's been spent on these judicial retention races topped, I think, what, $1 million last week? Well, what are the latest totals?
Right. Well, at this point, we've been tracking the amount of money spent on television advertising contracts via public files that are available, and then also some of the other advertising and spending that we've been able to put our fingers on. And to be perfectly frank, we haven't been able to put our fingers on all of it. Some of these amounts have not been fully disclosed as of yet. But what we can tell you certainly is that we have seen the amount of money spent on television advertising contracts really has gone pretty well over $1 million at this point. We had almost reached $1 million by the end of last week, and then the contracts continue to come in. So we saw some additional spending, and that has certainly put us over the $1 million mark for the television advertising spending. But as you know, in Tennessee, having followed this, television advertising is the largest component of the spending, but it's not the only component. So there's been some radio advertising as well, and some direct mail that's been done. And what we've seen happening in Tennessee is not unlike a trend we have noted nationally in the last couple of years, as these retention races start to become a magnet for spending and political activity. And this year, it appears to be Tennessee's turn.
Mm. Well, that gets us to our next point here. How does that break down in Tennessee among the groups that support the justices, the groups that oppose the justices? Who's spending the most, and what are they spending it on?
Right. Well, it's really kind of interesting because right now it appears as if it's somewhat fairly evenly split to the extent that we can really track it. So on the pro-retention side, of course, you have the three justices' own campaigns. There is another group, Tennesseans for Fair Courts, as you know, which is a pro-retention group advocating for their retention. On the television ad side, that spending has gone over about $700,000. On the television ad side, on the anti-retention groups, you have the Tennessee Forum and the State Government Leadership Foundation as the primary spenders, and that spending is about $445,000. Now, you also have the Republican State Leadership Committee, which made some headlines when it started to distribute direct mail. We know they spent about $196,000 on those direct mail pieces. And then we have a bit of a black box in that we know Americans for Prosperity is doing a significant radio campaign. That money has not been disclosed. And so we are fairly certain that there is some spending on the anti-retention side that we cannot totally pin down. We can say that the money we are able to identify looks about fairly evenly split right now, and the numbers are certainly significant.
Well, this gets to an interesting point as well about where the money is coming from. You happen to reference right. Americans for Prosperity. That is a national organization. They're not based here in Tennessee. So let's talk about geographically where this money is coming from.
Mm-hmm. This is an interesting question because most of it is still local in this race that we are able to identify. But one of the other national trends that has found its way to Tennessee this year is this rise in what we call independent spending by outside groups. And so over the recent years, as we've watched what's happening in judicial elections, we've seen more groups deciding not to give their money to candidates, deciding to go ahead and air their own television ads or produce their own direct mail pieces. And that's exactly what we've seen in Tennessee this year. We've seen the Tennessee Forum, which is a local group, placing ads independent of the justices' campaigns on television. And we've seen the Republican State Leadership Committee, which is a national group, and Americans for Prosperity doing some independent spending on their own. And what is very interesting about that trend, and frankly from our perspective is troubling about that trend, is when we see outside groups getting involved in judicial races, oftentimes they outspend the candidates themselves, and then the judges who are at the center of this whole issue really lose control of the narrative. They lose control of the campaign. And so it's a system that has been affecting contested elections nationally for a while now, and we've started to see it filter its way into retention races. Not to overstate it, retention races are still lagging behind contested elections when it comes to this type of spending, but this is what we see happening, and it's a cause for concern.
Well, let me jump right off of that then and ask you, because there are people who say, and it's an interesting point, it's a legitimate point, I think, that courts have said over the years consistently that campaign spending in the form of money is free speech. It's the same thing. You can spend money to support a candidate, to put together an advertising campaign. So if money is free speech, and these proponents say more money means more speech, and more speech is good for democracy, talk about what specifically concerns your group about these totals.
I think that what concerns us is that judicial selection is being run as a partisan race, and partisan politics is a cornerstone of our representative democracy, certainly. We all expect that when we're electing legislators to represent us, and we expect those folks to represent their constituencies. There is a lot of discussion to be had around the role of money in politics when you're talking about electing representatives as well. We set that aside for a moment, though, and just really talk about the fact that our founders intended judges to be different. They intended our justice system to be different. Partisan candidates have to run on platforms. That's what parties are all about, right? So you don't want judges running on platforms and perhaps signaling or feeling that they have to telegraph to voters how they might rule on a specific case. So what we prefer to see is, to the extent possible, judges not forced to behave like politicians and insulated from the money and politics that we've come to accept, I think, as a part of contests for legislative races, but cause some very significant problems when you see them infiltrating the process of selecting judges.
Okay. Lori Kenney is with the nonpartisan watchdog group Justice at Stake, joining us from her office in Washington. We're going to go to the phones now for our first question of the day. Dan in Knoxville, you are on Dialogue. Go right ahead.
Hello.
Yes, Dan, go ahead.
I just had a simple question. I'd like to vote to retain those judges, but as I understand it, it's a primary election, and I have to choose whether to vote Democrat or Republican. Which should I choose so I can vote to retain those justices?
Okay, well, that sounds like a Tom Humphrey question. Tom, have you looked at the ballots? I believe it's
sure.
on both.
And this is a general election. Whether you vote in the Republican primary or the Democratic primary, you can still vote on the retention election. You're going to find there are 23 judges. There's a whole long list of them down there that you will vote to retain or replace. But it doesn't matter which primary you vote in. That is a general election for the judges. It is not a primary election, so you'll be able to vote regardless of which primary you choose to vote in.
All right, Dan, did that answer your question?
Yes, thank you very much.
Fabulous. Thank you for calling in. Well, you know, we like to help people around here. That's what we do at Dialogue. So we'll get back to the subject of the money and the races themselves. Tom, I want to stick with you for just a moment. The proponents, and Lori and I were talking about this in sort of a different way a second ago, the proponents of electing the judicial branch say that judges should not get a free ride for life. It makes them less accountable. But opponents would argue that the independent judiciary is exactly what you would want, because then the judicial branch would not be forced to bow to the shifting populist winds or have to campaign for their jobs the way other elected officials do. Let's talk about how some of those arguments are playing out in the current retention election race. What role are those arguments playing?
Well, the Supremes are basically started out saying much as what Laurie is saying, that we want the courts to be fair and impartial. We don't want them to get politics involved here. They have gotten somewhat more aggressive in presenting themselves as, they are for the death penalty. They like to emphasize that they've upheld 90% of the death penalty cases. So they're sort of, that's a political statement. That's like a candidate for sheriff would say, I'm for the death penalty. They also have a line in their ads, you'll notice, they're strong on Second Amendment rights. Again, that's something a candidate for the legislature might say. They've creeped up there to getting more political themselves, and I believe they've done that because they feel they have to. On the flip side, the attempt by the opponents is to brand them as liberal Democrats. They use that phrase. They've thrown in Obamacare and, in my thinking, somewhat convolutedly declared that they tying them to Obamacare because the attorney general who they appointed did not file a lawsuit against the Affordable Care Act.
Right, and we should clarify the Supreme Court of Tennessee.
That's the branding. The Supremes have also worked hard here lately. If you notice the last couple of days, they've had news conferences around the state there in Knoxville with a couple of Republican prosecutors as well as a Democrat prosecutors to say that these Republicans are for the Supremes and their lawyers. And up in the Tri-Cities area, former Congressman Bill Jenkins endorsed the Supreme Court justices' retention. They had a couple of Republicans standing with them here in Nashville at a news conference yesterday. So they're trying to debrand them, to say we're not Democrats, although they are all three were appointed by Governor Phil Bredesen, who is a Democrat. And it sort of played out that way. I think, if I didn't want to go too long, but in our 2006 retention election, the last one we had 8 years ago, the drop-off on the ballot was like 50%. Half the people who went in to vote didn't get down to even cast a vote one way or the other on the judges. Mm. I don't know how that's going to play this year, whether people are going to get down there and vote on those. And if so, how are they branded? In 2006, about a third of the people who voted, when you got down there, just voted no. And I know a couple of folks who will just, I don't know that judge, I'll vote no. How does that play? It's a hard one to predict the outcome.
Well, let me ask you another question, though, about perhaps the future of these elections. A little earlier in the hour, you were telling us that this is an unusual thing, that this is the first time we've seen a high-dollar, high-stakes judicial retention election for the Supreme Court on this scale in Tennessee. But do you think this is the shape of things to come? Do you think that 8 years from now we'll be seeing the same thing, provided they don't get what they want this time, it'll be the next time and the next time?
Well, looking 8 years down the road is a little difficult. I think there is a good chance that this could become the norm and set the stage for it. On the flip side, if they, in 8 years, these three judges probably will not be seeking new terms. Don't know that. Gary Wade is probably old enough he would not do another term.
Yeah.
So if they have all Republican judges and we're still an all Republican state, or predominantly Republican state, well, maybe no one will bother and they'll slide through. Sort of a curious question, is there any spillover effect on these negatives? But there are those 20 other justices, Court of Appeals, Court of Criminal Appeals judges on the ballot. If people get in the habit of going down there and voting no, well, that could spill over to them. And then bear in mind, in November, we have a constitutional amendment on the judicial selection system.
That's right.
Basically validating what we now have, where the governor makes the initial appointment, that people have a retention election. It adds a requirement that the legislature have confirmed the governor's appointees on the initial front. So in some ways, this is sort of an assertion of legislative power. Say it initiated with Governor Ramsey.
Well, it
versus
also,
over the judicial branch, as
right,
well as
right.
We know the Republicans now have the executive and legislative branches of Tennessee.
Yeah, I was going to say it also introduces another point for politics to be introduced into the process, where the vetting through the legislature means you might have to say the right thing to the right people in order to win legislative approval. But again, that all depends on whether or not the amendment is approved. Lori, before we let you go, I wanted to broaden out the view just a little bit to beyond Tennessee. What we're seeing right now in the state, these television ads, the money coming in from groups on all sides. That's an example of what's happening in judicial races all over the country. And yeah, they're getting more expensive too. So tell us what's been going on nationally in the trends for judicial elections and what your group thinks the shape of the future might be in these elections.
Absolutely. And I would like to say I think Tom is probably right in suggesting this may be a new normal for Tennessee. The trend is relatively new for retention elections, so it's hard for us to know for sure. We know of one other state where they saw it twice, and that was Iowa. Two cycles in a row with their retention elections there. But again, it's a relatively new thing for retention elections. What we were able to pull together from the 2011-12 cycle, the last complete cycle that we watched, the judicial races in that year cost, about $56.5 million. Maybe doesn't sound like a lot when you're comparing that with congressional or presidential campaigns, but keeping in mind that until relatively recently and really starting around in the year 2000 or so, when we saw an explosion of this kind of spending on these races, it was almost nothing. So it's ramped up quite quickly. As I mentioned before, one of the other trends that we see is independent spending. Groups that say, I'm not going to spend my money donating to a candidate. I'm going to go right out there on TV and place my own ads that say exactly what I want to say to influence the race. Partisan groups of all stripes figured out a while ago that spending on judicial races at the state Supreme Court level gives you a certain amount of bang for your campaign buck that you might not necessarily get elsewhere. The races are generally less expensive. There are fewer candidates. The state Supreme Courts have tremendous influence locally over the political and economic lives of their states. So our executive director likes to say, this is the fishing hole that everybody discovered, and now you can't get them away from it. So that's one of the things that we've seen with these races over the last few years. The television spending has been on the rise for quite a while now. In 2011-12, that was about $33 million, actually almost $34 million. So we're definitely seeing an increase in the spending, an increase in the politicization, a trend towards the independent spending, a trend towards retention elections, which for such a long time were really almost immune to this problem being sort of roped in as well. This year, of course, we have judicial elections in a number of states, and we'll be watching very closely. You may know that North Carolina, neighboring state, had a $1.3 million primary back in May for a single Supreme Court seat, and that attracted some of the same out-of-state spending, including Republican State Leadership Committee spending that has now found its way to Tennessee. So Tennessee finds itself kind of in the middle of the storm right now. Whether it's a new normal for the state or not is going to be an interesting thing to watch, and that's what we do. We watch what happens with these kinds of contests nationwide. This is going to be a big year.
Okay, well, Lori Kenny, a lot to think about, and of course, a lot of stuff to keep an eye on as we all head to the polls tomorrow and start seeing those election returns tomorrow night as well. Thank you so much for taking part of your afternoon to talk with us about that.
Thank you so much.
All right. Lori Kenny joining us from her office in Washington, D.C. with the group Justice at Stake. We're going to pause right now for a brief break right here on Dialogue. And when we come back, we'll be talking about legislative races. Some of the local state races we'll be keeping an eye on as Tom Humphrey stays with us. We hope you will, too. At 1:41 Eastern Time, this is Dialogue from WUOT News. Welcome back to Dialogue right now as we come into the third and final portion of our program. We had to say goodbye to Lori Kenny, but Tom Humphrey, the Knoxville News Sentinel, is sticking with us. We're going to spend the last 18 minutes of our program today talking about some of the legislative races and other statewide topics of more local import. If you have a question for Tom, 974-5050. And again, we'll be focusing mainly on the local election, so if you could keep the topic to that. And so, Tom, let's get right into this. What are some of the interesting races you're going to be watching here in East Tennessee, just some high-profile or crucial sort of hinge races you'll be watching?
Well, I suppose the most watched race in the state is there in Knoxville. That would be Stacey Campfield, the incumbent senator and state senator in Senate District 7, facing Richard Briggs and Mike Alford. Mostly Briggs. That's been a Briggs versus Campfield contest. Very interesting, as I say, watched statewide because of Senator Campfield's high profile in the legislature, even nationally. You also got Steve Hall, state representative incumbent there, who has a formidable opponent in Martin Daniel. That's a close race. You have a primary for to oppose Gloria Johnson, one of the few remnant Democrats in East Tennessee, who is unopposed in her primary, but she has two Republicans, Mr. Edwards and Mr. Emmert, going against one another to see who will go up against Gloria Johnson in November. Outside the state, just to the north of Knox County there, Dennis Roach, a state representative, lives in Rutledge, Granger County.
That's right, yeah.
Has come under attack from a political action committee, Tennessee Federation for Children. This is a pro-voucher organization, and it has spent about $75,000 at last count trying to unseat Coach Roach, as he is known. Jerry Sexton is his opponent. Mr. Sexton has spent some of his own money, about $80,000 of his own. He had loaned his campaign. That $75,000 spent by the outside pack is, you know, that's more than Roach has spent on his entire campaign. So that is an intriguing race and situation there. Further north, up in northeast Tennessee, you have some, three incumbents facing very strident aggressive challengers. Those would be Tony Shipley of Kingsport, Micah Van Hus of Jonesboro, Matthew Hill, and Timothy Hill, his brother, has also got a challenger as well. Statewide, there are about 20 Republican incumbent legislators who are being challenged in Republican primaries, about four in Democratic primaries. That is a high number of challenges, and I'd say several of them, including those I've run through in East Tennessee, are fairly serious, formidable challenges. They could upset these incumbents. One could say that in some of these cases, at any rate, there are ideological differences. We have Republicans who are, we'll use the words establishment and Tea Party again. Perhaps that's not precise. Where one is an establishment candidate and the other is a Tea Party or a more arch-conservative candidate.
Right.
Those lineups vary from district to district. Sometimes the incumbent is that is being challenged is the conservative, Micah Van Hus, for example. Sometimes it's the or Stacey Campfield. Sometimes it is the more establishment candidate who is being challenged.
Well, I wanted to follow up with that with you, if you would. You had a piece that ran in Monday's News Sentinel that looked at some of the political action committees that are targeting Republicans in the legislature. And we have seen happen throughout the United States in many of these primaries this midterm year. We even talked about this a little bit earlier this hour, the fact that usually when a Republican is targeted, it's for not being perceived as being conservative enough. In other words, there's a more conservative challenger on the other side who wants to take that nomination, take that seat, potentially. But we also have a political action committee here in Tennessee that just formed last month that's doing exactly the opposite, throwing money at candidates who do represent the so-called the establishment or the more mainstream sort of big business conservatives. So you have these competing political action committees, one that supports conservatives, one that supports more moderates. Tell me about how that dynamic is shaping up in these races.
Well, that is an intriguing situation right there for a political junkie. Yes, Advance Tennessee was created on July 15th, and by July 28th had spent $140,000 attacking more conservative members of the legislature. That is a flip from 2012, for example. We had these conservative PACs that were attacking moderate members, and they're still there, too. But yes, Advance Tennessee, I had occasion to speak to Governor Haslam yesterday briefly about that, and it struck me that those people who are donating to put $150,000, like snap of your fingers, into that PAC, are all traditional donors to Bill Haslam and Beth Harwell, who are fairly moderate folks in the Republican circles. And the governor said, well, not so much, but he... And there seems to be Common Core is a hot-button issue. The supporters of that PAC, I believe it is fair to say, are all known as sort of supporters of Common Core, as is Governor Haslam. And
right.
Beth Harwell, to a lesser extent. It's super PACs come to Tennessee. That's one created in an instant, funded in an instant, and surprised these candidates with suddenly going after them. In one case here in Middle Tennessee, Mike Sparks, they spent $40,000 attacking him on TV and so forth in a race where he has spent $12,000.
Big fire.
A remarkable thing. Oh, and that it's a as an aside, the treasurer of this new Advance Tennessee PAC is the same treasurer of the national super PAC America Crossroads, set up by Karl Rove. Super PACs come to Tennessee.
Well, definitely worth noting and worth paying attention to. Now, it's unlikely that Governor Haslam, let me say this, extremely unlikely that Governor Haslam is going to lose his bid for re-election in November. There have not been serious challenges on the Democratic side, not much of a challenge from within the party. And as you were just talking about with Governor Haslam, with House Speaker Harwell and some other moderate Republicans or less conservative Republicans in high-ranking positions within the legislature, within the party. Do you think that tension is going to continue even after these elections, assuming that Governor Haslam is elected? They've got to deal with him for another 4 years.
Yes, I think that tension is going to continue and may even escalate. Some of the conservative activists are irritated that the governor's intervention, that he's ratcheting things up. And it is a novelty for Bill Haslam to get involved. I should mention that Governor Haslam has his own political action committee.
That's right.
He put $150,000 in that earlier this year and distributed it out, for the most part, defending money to support incumbents that he favors and he supports. He has not gone on the offensive against any with his own PAC. This other PAC is on the offensive against conservative Republicans. Oh, there is a mix there. The governor has been faulted on back to Common Core as relating into politics for having some closed-door meetings with various educators around the state here. I think he's had 12 this summer. And there's stories of apparently that was a topic there. The governor supports Common Core standards and was disappointed in the legislature's action to pull back on testing last legislative session. There are some folks ready to try all of that again next year. So there are policy ramifications. I think there will be some tension there.
Yeah. Well, Republicans in Tennessee, though, are not in any danger of losing ground. They solidified their control of the General Assembly into what's called a supermajority 2 years ago. Doesn't look like that's going to change. But what we have seen change is a number of longtime House and Senate Democrats deciding to either retire or just not run for another term. Does that mean that we expect Republicans will probably pick up a few seats, or will Democrats slide into those old legacy seats left behind? How do you think that's going to shake out in November?
The way our districts are designed, the Republicans drew the districts, the new districts, of course. There are now only 7 Democrats in the state Senate. It's very possible that there will be only about 5 after the November elections. 2 of those retiring Democrats, Senator Charlotte Burks and Lo Finney over in West Tennessee, are not seeking reelection. Those seats could go very easily to Republicans, leaving the Democrats with just 5 state senators out of 33. Over on the House, on the flip side, I think that Democrats might actually gain a seat or so in the House next fall. The districts are pretty much ironclad. They're either they've packed all the Democrats into districts and they've got Republican solid districts. There's only a handful of districts that are competitive across the state. One of those is in Knox County, Gloria Johnson's seat. That's a fairly competitive district. So the Republicans will be spending heavily in that race to try and unseat Gloria Johnson.
Do you think that's likely to happen?
Oh, I wouldn't call that one. I think Representative Johnson has a good chance of staying in office. I think there are some other seats around the state where there are those handful of Democrats-Republican balance seats where the Democrats could actually pull one off and gain a seat or two.
Interesting. Well, as we're talking about this, I want to ask you, as we go into this tomorrow night, let's sort of wrap all this up, bring it back to sort of our starting point. What are some of the bellwether races? If I'm, you know, got my popcorn and my remote in my hand and I'm watching election returns tomorrow night, what are some of the races you're going to be watching that you think will be the most significant in terms of their outcome? Which ones will be the most important by the time we wake up on Friday morning?
Well, of course, the most attention will be Lamar Alexander. Mm-hmm. And there, I think Senator Alexander is well positioned to win. The thing to watch there is by what percentage does he win? How strong a endorsement does he get from his own party? I think it is at least possible that he might only get a plurality victory, come in at 50% or less than 50% with Flynn and Carr and the other folks splitting up the other 50%. That would be sort of an embarrassment to Lamar Alexander. and might be interpreted as signaling a message of some sort. But if he could win by, say, 60%, then I think he could thump his chest again and ready go through the term and look and at least argue that he has a mandate for doing things the way he has been doing them. Mm-hmm. Governor Haslam, he's certainly going to win. The question there is who is the runner-up. Prediction, Mark Coonrippy Brown, number one on the ballot. Mm-hmm. And he would like to have a very solid, high percentage victory to sort of use his argument to go into the legislature next year and say, look, the Republicans supported me by 70%. That shows that you guys need to come along with the program here to the more conservative people, perhaps. So what level of support does the Governor Haslam have? And then the third and fourth congressional districts, of course, those are, at least in the fourth, Desjardins versus Tracy, that could probably be argued as an establishment versus Tea Party race, with Tracy the establishment candidate and Desjardins the Tea Party candidate. Mm-hmm. So that would be an indicator of whether the Republican Party, where it's going. The third is a little more complicated, but there, conversely, Weston Wamp is presenting himself as the new wave, new generation, more willing to work across the aisle candidate versus Chuck Fleischman, who is a very staunch anti-Obama sort of fellow.
Right.
Another
right.
good indicator race. So then you go down the list of legislature races. They're all over the map. Campfield Briggs, Stacey Campfield, rated, as he likes to brag, the most conservative senator in the state, and perhaps so, versus Briggs, a established surgeon, county commissioner. Governor Haslam likes him, has said things good about him.
Yeah.
Another clash of Republican values. And if the Democratic Senate primary there, if Gordon Ball is successful, he has enough of a personal fortune to at least be an annoyance to Lamar Alexander mm-hmm. in putting up ads and spending time and making some race out of it. Tennessee is still a Republican state, but that's one.
It could be something.
He would be perhaps better positioned than Terry Adams,
right,
having all his personal money to spend in a race for the fall.
We'll also be watching, of course, the judicial retention elections. You were talking about races that send a message, and I think those are three races right there that that you could interpret that way very easily, that if the justices lose, it sends one kind of message. If they win, it sends an entirely different kind of message.
Absolutely. In fact, that's maybe the strongest thing going there. That it would be very disheartening for Ron Ramsey to see the all three of them retained by a substantial margin. It would be very disappointing to the justices themselves, obviously, and to the legal community and the judicial community statewide, who have really rallied. I think that's what they have going for them in that race, is that law firms, the judges, the whole legal community has really worked to get votes out and educate people and get them to the polls. It's sort of a grassroots effort. That's their ace in the hole, I think, against this negative advertising. If that works, well, we have taken a new step in the direction of putting politics into the court system.
All right, Tom Humphrey, retired Nashville Bureau Chief for the Knoxville News Sentinel. Tom, thank you so much for joining us today. We appreciate it.
More an honor and a privilege.
As always, same here. Well, you've been listening to Dialogue from WUOT News. Greg Hill is our producer. We'd like to extend a special thank you to Spotland Productions in Nashville, which connected our conversation with Tom Humphrey. Also to Lori Kenny of the group Justice at Stake. 91.9 FM WUOT and WUOT HD1 Knoxville. It is 2:00 Eastern Time. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth.